Your nervousness is an inauthentic attempt at sympathy. It's an inauthentic attempt to get the audience to give you more love than you might otherwise deserve.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Sanziano, host of the Jake and Gino podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, father, six best-selling author, the G-Daddy. Gino Barber, Gene, how's it going?
Mr. Stenziano, I'd be lying to you if I said I wasn't super excited today. Amazing guest, amazing content, and I'm completely honest, everybody. Stop whatever you're doing. Pick up a pen and paper, because for the next hour, your speaking is going to go from here to here. And if you thought you were raising a couple hundred grand, by the end of this call, you're going to be raising millions of dollars. And I'm being completely honest. This man is an amazing speaker, transformational speaker, and not even that. He's an amazing entrepreneur. Maybe we'll touch on to that, but I think really focusing on getting to become a better speaker is what this podcast is all about. Jake, take it away, brother.
Hey, if you didn't just pull your car over, you didn't put the pencil down, you didn't get focused, you're dead. So here we go. Our guest today has begun his entrepreneurial career as a child selling lemonade and shoveling snow. I know a little bit about that growing up in Western New York. He is now a serial entrepreneur and educator, helping others build businesses that improve their quality of life. So without further ado, Eric Edmeads, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to have you guys here. You got great energy. I already know this is going to be great.
We are bringing the Panya. We had Gino singing opera earlier. We're doing it. So, hey, we want to unpack your story. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started out as an entrepreneur.
You know, it started off by growing up in a house with my mom, who was a devout socialist and had all of her socialist friends hanging around at the house. She went to the School of Social Work, and all these social workers were sitting around drinking beer and smoking dope and having parties. And that's how quickly I identified. In fact, in the bio, it says I was like selling lemonade and shoveling sidewalks. Yeah, I did. But here's my very first business. My mom's socialist friends would come to the house with their beer, but our fridge couldn't fit all of it. Right. So what did I do? Well, I would make ice. When I knew a party was coming, I would make ice, and then I'd put ice in the bathtub, and then I'd get their beer, put it in the bathtub, and I'd all night sell their beer back to them. It's called value added marketing, right? And I learned this because
how did that go over in a socialist household?
They loved it. You see, the thing is, they loved it because it was perfect value add, right? They were getting value, so they saw the sense in it. In fact, at one point, one of my mom's really good friends, Grant, he at about 10, 11 o'clock at night, they were all getting too tired to come in, too tired and maybe a little too drunk to come get the beer. So I started walking the party with beer. I upped the value. You got to always, how do you add more value? And so Grant stops me at one point and he goes, and I'm like 11. And he goes, you're a capitalist. And I had no idea what a capitalist was. I didn't know, but I knew from growing up around these people that they were evil. I didn't know what they were, but they were bad. And he was calling me one. Then he goes, I go, no, I'm not. And he goes, I'll give you $5. Now think, this is $1980, right? Like, what is that today? He goes, I'll give you $5 if you'll admit that you're a capitalist. And I was like, I can't do it. I don't know what a capitalist
That's
is.
That's at least $20 today, by the way.
At least. Many years later, I bumped into him in my super nice sports car, bumped into him. We're having a chat. And I go, hey, I want my $5 now that I know what a capitalist is. And he goes, you're doing just fine on your own. But what I'm really getting at is that as a kid, I really understood something. And it was because my grandparents were unbelievably wealthy, but they had cut us off financially because we left South Africa and they weren't happy about that. So I was growing up in this dichotomy of we would go visit our grandparents and drive around in Mercedes and go to the best game reserves in the country. And then we'd come home and we couldn't afford gifts at Christmas one year. You know, it was like I grew up in both of these realities, and that showed me that if I was going to have any kind of independence financially in my life, it was going to be up to me. And that's what started me off.
Okay, I got to understand this, and this is going to go way off the rails here, but what the hell happens? You grow up in a very prosperous, and maybe I don't know the politics of your grandparents, but how do you go from a very, it sounds like probably pro-capitalistic grandparents to the complete opposite? What happened to cause the socialist revolution with your mother?
Oh, hell, I don't know. I think it's a number of things. We were in white South Africa. And I think that a lot of, if you think about it, the politics of racism was more right wing in that. And I'm not saying right wing is racist. I'm just saying that in the politics of South Africa were more right wing and a little bit more, obviously, very legislatively racist. And so my mom was very much in support of the then ANC and so on. And so when they came to Canada,
you know, Canada's a significantly more liberal country, and they came there with all kinds of ideals. And you know, for example, they enrolled me in a multi-race school. Now, that may seem normal in North America, but what most people never really realize is that apartheid was alive and well in Eastern Canada. Sure, you guys had slaves in America, and we let them come to Canada to escape all you evil Americans, but we made them live in their neighborhoods. Right. And so gotcha. Even when I grew up in Canada, there was a clear distinction between white and black neighborhoods and stuff. And so my parents, my mom particularly, leaned really heavily toward the sort of more socialist side of it because of that. And that just spilled into the economics, I think. My mom's a decided capitalist today. She's working on the most incredible app. It's like you're driving along in your car and it gives you a tour of wherever you are, you know, and she's like in her 70s developing this app. So she came around. She came around.
It was compassion. It got pulled into like a political thing where it wasn't necessarily intended. I got it.
Eric, more importantly, how did you pull away from that? Because we all want to blame our parents. You know, I'm a life coach. We have energy blocks. We have limiting beliefs. Oh, my mom made me do it. I know. I love your story at 15. You said you were homeless. How did you pull away from that and become or develop the capitalistic mindset?
There are a couple things that happened. I had this one conversation with my mom when we went to go visit her parents. And I noticed that my mom, look, we all have multiple personalities, all of us. You are different with your wife than you are with your children, than you are with your boss, than you are with your customer. Like, we all put on these shells, right? And I watched my mom slip into the shell of a child in front of her mother and father. Like, she would start talking. And I already did not speak to my parents like that. I had already sort of done this emancipation thing of like, my parents were more like friends than they were parents at that stage. Mm-hmm. Not that they weren't my parents, but I think you understand. I didn't have this huge deferential, you know, attitude. And we got there and I said to her one day, why do you do that? Like, why do you become a little girl around your parents? And she kind of, you know, I don't think she'd
even. That's
a
heavy question, by the way. Mom that. Like, damn, man.
But that's the point. Think about it. It's only proof of what I'm saying is that my mother and I had a very direct, like, connected relationship. Yeah. It wasn't this differential, like, you know, ranking. And I think that watching that taught me a lot about what growing up really was going to be about and you know, the independence. And, you know, as you mentioned, I was homeless at 15, and that's because I had a major disagreement with my parents had split up, and I was living with my father in Western Canada, and he and I had a serious disagreement about my schooling. And, you know, he'd sent me off to this really intense boarding school, and halfway through grade 10, I said, I'm not going back. That's not for me. And he didn't agree with me. And that resulted in me being on my own. And at 15, and by the way, like, whatever winter you think you've been dealing with in the Eastern United States, let me just tell you, Edmonton, Alberta, that's all I got to say. It's minus 40. And you know what's great about minus 40? I don't have to translate that for you because minus 40 is the same in Celsius and Fahrenheit. And here's where I got one of my big life lessons. Had it been summer when I was homeless, it would have been really easy to find a park bench to sleep on. It would have been really easy to survive out there and become a homeless kid. But it was minus 30, minus 40 degrees. I didn't have that choice. I had to become entrepreneurial to dig myself out. And as example, there was a video arcade that we used to go to back in the days when you put coins in machines to play video games. And I walked in there and the owner looked tired. And I'm 15 years old and I walk up to him and I go, you look really tired. And he goes, and by the way, I know we're here talking about influence, so there's a reason for this story. I noticed who he was. I noticed he's my target audience. I noticed that he's tired. I spoke to him about his needs. And I went to him and I said, listen, Ray, you look really tired. And he goes, I am. And I go, I think I know why. Why? And can you imagine, I'm 15, I look 12. And he's like, what do you mean why? And I go, well, you're here until 3 o'clock in the morning and you come here and open at 10 every morning. And that's got to be killing you. And he goes, yeah. And I go, I'll make you a deal. I will stay at night and watch the place for you. And I'll open it first thing in the morning. You can stroll in at 12 and you can leave and have dinner with your family. He goes, I'm not hiring. I go, I'm not looking for a job. I said, you just got to let me sleep in here at night and I'll do that for you. And the next thing you know, I wasn't sleeping on the streets anymore, but guess what? Then I had a job and pretty soon I was doing stuff for him and he was giving me money. And I, you know, it was the ultimate, like, the reality of capitalism. If I did not find a way of adding value, I was not going to eat. Mm-hmm.
If you're not watching this on YouTube, everybody, I would tell you to go on there because we're going to talk about speaking. And I've been studying the speaking. Eric, with the amazing stories, everybody, listen to the stories he's giving you, his body, his inflection, the way he's delivering it. It's amazing. I want to jump into the speaking. But first thing, let's talk about WildFit because you're an amazing entrepreneur. You've started so many different companies. Let's talk about WildFit for 2 minutes. Let everyone know what it is. And then we'll jump into the speaking.
Sure. I'll put it this way is once I'd achieved what I wanted, you know, my first business was mobile computing, data capture, barcode scanning, logistics management. And I sold that business. And then I took 2 years off traveling around the world.
Jake, can you say that twice? Can you say that again, Jake?
I don't know what he just said. It sounded like he's scanning UPCs, but UPCs probably not even relevant anymore. So
there you go. And that's, by the way, how I felt about it. By the time I sold the company, I didn't even want to do my own grocery shopping because they had barcode scanners in there. But in any event, I bought a film studio in Northern California, and it was originally the home of Industrial Light and Magic. So we were working on Avatar and Pirates of the Caribbean and really doing cool stuff. And when I eventually got out of that business, I really made a decision about what I wanted to do. And that's what kind of led to WildFit is that I asked myself, I'm living a great life and I'm aware of it. I'm very fortunate. I'm a very lucky guy. I get to live an incredible life. And I thought, well, what are the gifts that I gave myself that empowered this? And there were three major gifts that I'd given myself. The one is that I had overcome my fear of public speaking. And there is nothing more valuable in the world than influence and the ability to tell your story effectively. Nothing. It is the skill that will differentiate anybody in their career, in their business, in their entrepreneurial ventures. And I'd given myself that gift. I'd given myself another gift, and that was I'd understood business and entrepreneurship, which means I'd given myself the gift of initially financial independence and then eventually financial freedom. The biggest gift that I gave myself, though, was reimagining my relationship with food and reimagining my relationship with my body, because I had been sick for most of my childhood. I wasn't like, you know, terminal or, you know, but I just was sick all the time, allergies and facial, you know, acne and throat infections and digestive problems. It was just, I was that kid. And in a single month at the age of 21, I turned all of that around. Mm-hmm. And that gift is what gave me the energy to build the life that I've lived. And those three gifts are ultimately what I now give back to the world through Speaker Nation with public speaking, through business freedom, through entrepreneurship, and WildFit to help people change their relationship with food.
What is your relationship with food? I really want to unpack this because in the last few months, like I'm you know, fighting dad bod. I'm getting near 40 now. And I love to just eat. I love heavy, you know, pizza with cheese. And I want to be able to wring the grease out of it. But ultimately, if I want to live a fit life, my relationship, and I'm really interested to hear what you have to say right now, with food is more of a means to an end. We were talking about like socialism, really. But ultimately, it's I'm going to look for the nutrients that I need to get the desired fitness result.
That's
and
not
it's not,
doing.
It's not enjoyable, but that's the, no, and this is why I want to
He's
hear
like,
you.
It's
the
only way.
It's the only way that I'm finding to get the end result. So like, you know, expand my mind right now because I'm not living my best life when it comes to food, man.
So. In theory, humans are the smartest species on the planet, but we suffer with more debilitating sickness, suffering, and disease than any other species on Earth, with the exception maybe of our pets and livestock. And guess what? We feed them too. Mm-hmm. If you are fed by humans, you're in trouble, and that's because, as much as I am a capitalist, there are certain things that capitalism really shouldn't be involved with. And one of them is food production. We have a food production regulation, legislation, and lobbying system that was bought and paid for by all of the food manufacturers. And there aren't that many of them. You might think that there's 30 or 40 of them, but there's about 6 or 7 and they own them all. And so what you believe is good for you or not is more a result of what they think is profitable. And think about this. If you want to boost profitability, you have to reduce your production costs. How do you reduce the production costs? You reduce the quality. So that means most of the food we eat today is nutritionally garbage. Then on top of that, if you want to increase your profitability, you have to get people to buy more than they need. And so what do you need to do? You need to get people to eat more food than they could possibly ever need.
Portion sizes explode. Yeah.
Portion sizes explode. If you want to notice a difference, you fly to Estonia and go to a restaurant and they will bring you the main course. And you as an American will think it's a starter. It's the main course.
Mm-hmm. And the fist, right?
That's the size of your stomach. Your stomach is the size of your fist. But the beautiful thing is your stomach is designed for gluttony. It's designed for feast and famine because in the hunter-gatherer world, when we killed a mammoth, you didn't go, oh, I'll just eat a fist-sized piece of mammoth. You know, you ate as much as you could possibly get in because you didn't know if you were going to have it the next
day.
Same thing. Yeah. You stumbled upon a tree full of fruit. You didn't just, oh, I'll just eat a few pieces. Your craving for sugar would drive you to consume as much of that and extend your stomach. And the food manufacturers know all of this. And they're playing into it. And this, by the way, let's not go, like you guys want to talk about speaking influence. Let me just say this. By learning about public speaking, by understanding the psychology of influence, I have designed a program that has an 85% completion rate over 3 months. And 2 years later, our clients report that they're still on track. We've had over 50,000 people in 130 countries radically change their relationship with food, reverse their diabetes, lose the weight that they could never lose, create the body that they really wanted. It is the greatest pride of my life to have created this company. And I love it. And I'll tell you right now, I could never have done it if I didn't overcome my fear of public speaking and become effective at using speaking and storytelling as a form of influence.
Wild fit, everybody. And I just watched a video the other day with Eric. The one thing that is killing us is sugar, over 50 forms of sugar. And what they do is they don't list it on one. They break it down into maltodextrin, into glucose and high fructose corn syrup. That's just a tip that I know that you think you're eating healthy. You think you're eating organic. Read the labels. Watch Eric's videos because he's going to teach you how to eat healthy. And it's really, really important that you look at it. And it's not your fault. Like Eric said, sugar is addictive. You start eating it, you start eating more and you get healthy. Sugar makes you, you get obese, you become obese. Sugar gets you to eat more, you get more hungry, you crave more and you eat more. And there's a vicious, vicious cycle going on. I don't know if you want to add to that, Eric.
Yeah, Gino, I do. I want to say this, that this is really important. I don't believe in diets. Nobody should ever go on a diet ever again. Mm-hmm. Diet in science means way of life. If you and I, if we're all watching a nature program and it says, oh, look, there's the cheetah, then some guy will come on in a vaguely South African, Australian, English accent. And he'll say, oh, look, the fantastic cheetah has a diet of 2.5 kilograms of fresh meat on a daily basis. Like that's what diet means. Going on a diet isn't a thing. We've made it a thing, but it isn't a thing and it's dangerous. And the reason I'm saying that is what you just said is go watch Eric's video. He'll teach you what to eat. Yeah, I will. But what I will really do is reframe the relationship people have with food so that they do not have to use willpower. Here's two things
that's
I
tough,
want you
right?
to never have
willpower
again.
Is a tough one to fight every day. Yeah.
The thing is, it isn't. It is because the diet industry has asked us to use a muscle that is designed for short-term transformation as a tool of permanent. Willpower is this.
Let me reframe that though. Like when you're getting I was watching The Office last night and the size of these chicken sandwiches that were every other ad and the cheeseburgers with the cheese dripping off. And then the pizza that looked amazing. It's getting pushed in your face. And then it's like, you're speaking to your spouse and it's like, please don't bring this shit back into the house because when I go into the cabinet, it's going to be right there. So there's temptation after temptation where you have to create your environment.
But what if there was no temptation? What if somebody could bring a big, thick cheese and pizza into the house and you didn't even want it? That's what we give.
And I'm smelling it and the cheese and the grease is dripping and I don't even want to touch that.
But what if as you smelled that smell, you felt your blood thickening?
Yes.
What if as you smelt the smell, you noticed that you actually felt your blood
thickening?
And you
take it away like the thing I love most in this life, man. Don't do this to me, man. Don't do me like that, man.
But you got it. Now notice what just happened is I've given you what we call a Frankl moment, named after Viktor Frankl. Yeah. And that is I've given you a moment that you can assess a new meaning. You watch, Jake, you watch. The next time somebody brings some greasy ass dripping cheese molasses pizza into your house, there will be a tiny moment where you're like, is my blood thickening? Just because of the way I said that to you. And that moment is the moment where you get to go, maybe I shouldn't do this. And the very first time you don't do that, you have listened to the little angel. And the stronger you, the more you listen to it, the louder it'll get.
Listen to Eric, bro.
Here's true story on this too, by this way. This weekend, we went out. I had a New York strip. And I've never seen so much fucking butter in my entire life. The restaurant I went to, it was across the entire top and about an inch thick. I felt fucking disgusting after I, because I've been eating clean recently. And it shut me down. It was too much. It was overkill. And I was saying to my wife the next day, I'm like, I literally feel hungover from eating that steak. It was too much. So like,
Jake, what did you eat with the steak? What did you eat? Did you have potatoes?
Oh yeah. And then, well, that was the other thing because I was looking for something else on the menu.
It wasn't the steak.
And they had those steak frite things, those little thin, they're fucking amazing. But dude, I'm telling you, I just felt like, ugh.
But it's so important that you get this. Yeah. It wasn't the steak. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, I was thinking it was the butter on top of the steak.
It was the potatoes combining with the steak.
Yes. Okay.
You and I, let's say the three of us go kill a mammoth. We got our mammoth over here. Nobody's going, hey, before we throw that on the fire, can we round up some potatoes? First of all, there were no potatoes. They're a 400-year-old food, but it wasn't the steak. That's a good, well-raised piece of steak is one of the healthiest things in the world you can eat. But when you convolute it with all this other stuff,
thinking it was the butter. I love steak, right? Obviously, I'm not butter's like, fine. I was just like, yeah.
Butter's better than margarine, but let's just going back to going back to influence and storytelling, let me give you an example. Gino, you're talking about sugar. Now, sugar is not bad and sugar is not good. Sugar is both bad and good in another way. There are good sugars, there are bad sugars, and then there are bad ways to even eat good sugar. So what we want is a better relationship with sugar. So check this out. In food, if I start saying to you, Gino, you got to stop eating the sugar, then here's what happens. You go to the store and you pick up the jar and you start reading. You start reading and you go, oh, shit, there's sugar. And you put it down and you have FOMO, fear of missing out. You're angry. You're annoyed. And those emotions are trigger emotions for food, which means you're going to end up eating sugar. Your anger or your frustration or your regret is going to create an emotional emptiness in you, which you are going to satisfy with a Cinnabon. Right? Something's going to come along to get your attention. But now what I do is I go, listen, Gino, here's what I want you to do. The next time you go into the shop and you pick up a jar of Ragu or Prego, which is supposed to be their organic blend mix, you're going to notice that sugar is in the top one or two or three ingredients. And at that point, what I want you to do is I want you to take the jar and I want you to smash it on the floor at your feet in the grocery store. And I want you to do that right now, because if everybody just smashes them, then they'll stop putting them on the shelves. Now, of course, I'm kidding, because I don't want to get you arrested. But what I want you to know is that if you get angry with the manufacturer, you are less likely to buy it. Whereas if you have regret that it's your own willpower that's holding you back, it's you you're mad at. Okay, now just let me unpack this for a second.
Then it's a brand discussion. Wow.
But you see, but here's the thing. You still think I was talking about the sugar and the Prego. What I was showing you is you will not be able to go into the grocery store over the next couple of weeks without picking it up, looking at the ingredient and smiling to yourself about smashing it on the floor. The story is in you now. And so, and all that means is that when you look at it, you go, shit, there's sugar. I should smash this on the floor. In that moment, you are having a much more resourceful thought about the food, and it's given you a moment of consciousness. That's what a well-told story is going to do. It's going to embed itself as a memory, and that memory is going to start to give you freedom.
No more stakes, Jake. We're going to the speaking, because this is...
He gave me the green light on the steaks, man. I might have one tonight. Right?
Stay away from the potatoes, bro. That's all. Five steps to overcoming stage fright, because this is where most of us start out. And Eric, I'll start out by saying I was scared in the beginning, but the guy on the other side of the screen over there, I have to do it for him. I have to do it for Jake and Gino. So that's how I overcome my fright. I have an accountability partner, and I say to myself, what's the worst thing that can happen? And just doing it for them. If I'm all by myself and I'm on an island, that I'd probably become more frightful, but I overcame my stage fright by being held accountable and wanting to do better for others. And that may sound crazy, because you're more willing to do stuff for others than you are for yourself, but that's sort of how I overcame it. Now, we've been speaking for, you know, hundreds of hours on the podcast and all, and it's just repetition after repetition, but let's go over these five steps, because I love your training, you know, the successful speaking strategies. You have that course on your website at Speaker Nation. Everyone go to speakernation.com, check out Eric's website, tons of resources on there. He's got master classes. He's got, you know, so much information on there, but let's go over these five steps if you can real quick for us.
Gino, can I back up first though? Because
absolutely.
So one of the things is that when you're constructing a presentation of any kind, you have to recognize that there are four basic thought processes or learning models. There are some people that will not learn a damn thing from you if they don't know why they're learning it. So if you don't address the why, they won't hear anything else you say. There's another group of people that don't even really care so much about the why. They just want to know what you're teaching. Then there's another group of people who don't even care that much about the what. They just want to know how to. They're very practical. They're the kind of people, the minute you start teaching it, they're doing it.
Engineers.
And then there's another group of people. Right. Then there's another group of people that are the possibility people. They're like what we call what if learners. This comes from a system called Format. And in the what if learners are going, yeah, but what if this happens? And what if that happens? And they're running the possibilities. Now, the reason I bring this up with you is that we can talk about the steps of overcoming, you know, public speaking, but the fact is that anybody who has an actual fear of public speaking doesn't want to know the five steps of overcoming public speaking. Like they just don't. I know, because I was one of them. I was so terrified that it would make me vomit. I was terrified. So let's just talk a little bit about why. First of all, nobody was born afraid of public speaking. Nobody was. I can prove it to you. Just get on any Southwest Airlines flight with a two-year-old and fly anywhere, and you will find that that child has no problem expressing itself, right? It has no problem expressing itself. And it is only as a result after 2 years old of everybody going, shh, stop, indoor voice, think before you speak, that we start getting our public speaking trained out of us. And then another thing happens to us, and that is that we go to school, and I want you to imagine this. There are two children doing a presentation. One kid aces it, tells good stories, does a great presentation, has great props.
The next kid is crying and shaking. Which kid gets the most love? The crying, shaking kid. And now every child in the audience has noticed that if you look nervous, you get more points. And so we got trained to act nervous about public speaking. And pretty soon that training became our reality. So I first of all want to just make it clear that nobody is naturally afraid of public speaking. It's a learned thing and we can undo it. But now we have to talk a little bit about why before I can really answer your question. I don't care what it is that you do for a living, your capacity to share your information in a memorable way, in an influential way, will make a 10x difference minimum in what it is that you are doing in the world. Warren Buffett has a number of degrees and honorary degrees, and none of them hang on the wall of his office. You know what hangs on the wall of his office? The Dale Carnegie public speaking course that he did. That's what hangs on the wall. That's the value. He even was speaking to a graduating class once and said, I'll give any of you $100,000 in cash right now for 10% of your income for the rest of your life. But if any of you take a public speaking training, I'll give you 150 grand. Like the value of public speaking is unbelievable. If you're an orthopedic surgeon, it means you get to do all the business class flights around the world and speak at the conferences. If you are an entrepreneur, it means that you can sell really well and you can raise money. If you are trying to speak to investors, it makes a 10 to 100 times difference in your ability to raise money, no question about it. So, So if anybody's afraid, I want them to know there's a strong why and that it totally is doable. So how do we overcome it? Couple things. The one is, I already started on a little bit, is recognizing that it's not natural, that it is not a natural thing. So here's the deal. From now on, you never, ever admit to anybody ever again that you're nervous about public speaking. You don't admit it with your words. You don't say it with your body. You don't demonstrate it in any way at all. Here's why. Nervousness. Everybody says, oh, but Eric, you say that you should be authentic on stage and I'm nervous. So it's authentic for me to show that I'm nervous. Bullshit. There's nothing going to happen to you up there. Nobody's going to throw rotten tomatoes at you. You're not in any danger. So what are you nervous of? Your nervousness is an inauthentic attempt at sympathy. It's an inauthentic attempt to get the audience to give you more love than you might otherwise deserve. And so nervousness is an inauthentic communication. So you must, like, you don't go to the audience, go, oh, I'm really nervous, or show with your body you're nervous. Because I did it once. I did a talk. My dad asked me to do this talk for him he's in AA and he wanted me to come and do this talk for him. And I went there and I was so terrified and nervous. And after I did my talk, which was apparently really good, all these people came up to me and said, oh my God, Eric, that was the best talk ever. We hope you'll come back. And you know, I'm telling you right now, I did not believe one of them. And the reason I didn't believe one of them is that I knew that they were telling me this because I looked so terrified and afraid that they were simply helping me to feel better. On the other hand, I stood on stage in Mykonos, Greece 4 years ago and did a talk called The Hindsight Window, which is, you know, one of my favorite talks. And I started the talk by saying this: I'm so glad I have this opportunity to share this concept with you because I'm about to give you a talk that I believe you will remember for years to come. Now, if anybody comes up to me afterward and tells me it was a great talk, they're not giving me sympathy. They're giving me truth. And so step one is you never, ever tell the audience you're nervous and you don't show them. Step two, I don't actually remember the five you have, but I'm going to give you five anyway. Step two is it's really important to remember that oxygen is incredibly important, yes, but not breathe. Simply oxygen, but the way the oxygen gets into you. A prey animal, upon hearing a leopard growling behind it, will suddenly breathe more quietly. It'll breathe in a very shallow, quiet way. And when you breathe really quietly, your body goes, I must be in a dangerous situation. And so your body starts producing adrenaline, cortisol. Neither chemical is useful for you on stage. They're just not. By the way, the more fearful you become with your adrenaline cortisol, the less empathy you have, the less intelligence you have. And so now you're on stage with lack of empathy and lack of intelligence, and it's going to go badly. So one of the most powerful things you can do to be more comfortable before you go and speak to a group of investors or stand on stage or lock your camera is do some deep lung-filling breathing, the kind of breathing that only a predator would do. You know, like just like, because you wouldn't be afraid.
Gino, that's why you always do this stuff. I see Gino doing it, singing opera, beating his chest. I'm like, what the fuck's this guy doing over here? Now I get it. He knows. Hey,
I listen to Eric, my friend. I listen to the gurus. He's not the guru. He's the guru. He's doing it while he's teaching it, my friend. Sorry, Eric, to interrupt.
It just makes sense, man. And then now the third one. Third one is your eye movements. Now, again, this is a prey animal. Right? Like a prey animal's darting around and focusing on stuff.
you know, you're walking along. Let's say the three of us are in Africa. I spend a lot of time in Africa. Over the last 10 years, I've been like staying with the Hadza Bushmen on a regular basis to kind of get a view of their version of life. And I'll tell you what, you're walking along and you see a lion print on the ground. You focus on that, baby. You don't gaze at it. You focus on it. You want to know how big it is. How many family members does it have? Does it have cubs with it? What direction is it walking in? And how long ago did it make this print? You want to know that information. So when you focus your eyes, your body immediately assumes that there's a threat or opportunity for you. And that means adrenaline. Whereas when you casually gaze at the world, when you relax your eyesight and you gaze at the world, your body goes, I must be safe. I wouldn't be gazing like this if there was a lion nearby. And so one of the things you do before you go on stage is do relaxing eye gazing exercises, because it communicates to every cell in your body that you're not under any kind of threat.
The crowd thinks you're safe too. Like, it's the whole hand thing. Like, get your hands out there. This person is safe, not a predator coming at me. That makes a lot of sense.
They feel it. If you're nervous, then they get nervous. So no good. Now, fourth one is this, is that never, ever, ever write out a speech ever again. Do not rehearse your speeches. Don't write them out, because there are two types of memory. There's memorization and there's remembering. And if you write out your speech, then you are using memorization. Think about that. If you have a 1,000-word speech, you have 1,000 things to remember. And you know how it works. If you lose one sentence, you're losing the next sentence, because you've remembered them in a chain, right? Instead, we use something called speech mapping, which is basically to say, here are the 6 points that I want to make, and here are the 6 stories I'm going to use to make those points. And now you only have to remember 6 things. It's like 6, 1 point, 1 story, 1 point. You remember them in pairs. It's so easy. And instead of memorizing what you're going to say and worrying about the words, you speak from your authentic experience of those stories. And then you don't have to memorize anything, and you feel much more natural. You don't have to, you don't need notes. And of course, now you're a lot more calm. And I need a fifth one.
So thank you for that, though. Seriously, because we do various presentations. We have conferences throughout the year. And we've, in the last few years, started doing that, because I always struggled. I'm like, Gino, my memory sucks. I can't remember shit. And if we get up there, I just need a few points to keep us on track. And that's sort of the direction we've gone in. But I always felt that I was doing something wrong, or I wasn't doing it right, because I could never remember anything. So, dude, you made my day. Thank you for that.
Let me repeat these real quick. This is from Eric's class. See the way you want it, right? See the way you want it, number one. Number two, breathe. Sul mare luccica. I'm getting myself into state. Remember, we got to get ourselves into state, into the right state. I'm singing Gregorian chant, believe it or not, because we're not the heroes here. We are the guides. I want to think of myself as being a guide in the show, putting myself in the right posture. Right now, Eric is the hero, and everyone listening to this show is the hero. So how do we perform for them? It's not about us. It's about them. I'm trying to deliver massive value. So get yourself into the right state by breathing.
And it doesn't have to be opera. In my case, it's Led Zeppelin. You know, do whatever you want.
I was Guns N' Roses, but you know what? My kids got me into this opera thing. So it is what it is. Soften the eyes, number three. Number four. Whoa,
what the hell is salt in the eyes? You guys soften, are like blowing my mind.
Soften.
I'm like, dude, that sounds nasty, dude.
You're not afraid anymore.
Yeah. See what happens when you think about steaks? No salt. Soften the eyes, number 4.
I was getting a tuna.
And number 5, create predictable start and finish. I love that, because you start out predictably and you end with a nice quote.
Let's unpack that. Not predictable. You don't, not for the audience predictable, predictable
yes.
for you.
For you, yes,
and
exactly.
This is really key. We talk about the development of an F-15. The F-15 is your first 15 seconds, 15 minutes, 15%. It depends on how long your talk is, but it's the start. And the metaphor is that an F-15 fighter plane uses half of its fuel just to get in the sky on a short flight, like a half of its fuel. So what we suggest is that if you put half your effort into your launch, the rest of your talk will be easy. And so having a really clear introduction, an icebreaker, a funny little joke, or, you know, like if you're in a town that just won some sports championship, you talk about that, like something to break the ice with the audience. Then, and you're so right, it's also the L-15 or the landing. And you guys have all seen a speaker that's like gone over time or something like that. A lot of times when speakers go over time, which is, by the way, one of the worst things you can do as a speaker, because it messes up every other speaker's schedule. It messes up the producer's schedule. And there are people in the audience that plan their day around what you told them to start.
Did Rick Sapio pay you to say this?
No.
Dude, we literally had this conversation yesterday. We were doing pre-planning for an event we have coming up, and we got this whole thing. Anyway, so I just want to make sure that, like, this is not, you're not a mole. This is not a plan.
No, not a plan. I'm clear about it. There is one exception. At my programs, I am allowed to go over time because I have my relationship with the audience, and I let them know that that might be going on. But if I'm speaking at your event,
The only way I'm allowed to go over time is if you ask me to, not the audience, you, the producer. Mm-hmm. Now, one way to make sure that you end on time, and this is classic, is that you know your landing. You know exactly what story you're finishing with. So if you know that you've got this kind of 3-minute story that you're going to wrap and land on, and it'll just, and it'll, then the couple things happen. One is that when you know you have 3 minutes left to go, you know to start your story. So you're easing into your finish. But the other thing is that you can play with that story and you tell it one way, one time. And then you notice that if you told it this way and you extend the pauses, you get a standing ovation. And so after a while, that story will improve in quality and you'll be able to end your talk with more greater predictability. And it changes everything. You're so calm. You look at the clock and it goes, I have 5 minutes to go. If you don't know how you're ending, you're like, you now have to devote a huge amount of your mental power to how am I going to wrap this thing up in the next 5 minutes? Whereas if you know you're ending on a quote or a story or an example, it's just boom, done.
Gino, wow. Out of the great Bill Walsh's playbook, 49ers always scripted the first 15 plays. They won a shit ton of Super Bowls because of it.
Hey, Jake, yeah. I got a couple more questions here. I forget the short answers because we got some. There's a couple of things I really want
to
dive into.
He just told me I'm done. And like, he just told me to go home.
Fine, you know why? There's a ton of value here. And this is what this, I think, is key for every syndicator or for everyone looking to raise capital, the storyboard. Eric, I taught this yesterday for the Jake and Gino community because I want people to have stories. You know, we have the stories of 2009 when Jake and I met, our first deal, our third deal using a mentor, all the different stories about the four energy levels, about the energy blocks, all that. I have stories I can pull out on a dime and be able to present. Can you discuss what a storyboard is and just how to create a storyboard?
Well, okay. So there's two different things. There's one thing that we call a speech map, which is mm-hmm. where you put your stories. And then the other thing is a story mm-hmm. journal, where story journal. I highly recommend that people keep their stories in a journal, not written out, bullet pointed.
Yes, bullet point.
Because if you write mm-hmm. them out, you'll try to memorize
them.
Love
this guy.
I don't want that. Just don't do that. Now, here's the magic of it. First thing is that you have life experiences. You guys and everybody listening has life experiences that are, they're kind of like a dusty old Rembrandt in the attic of your old house. You don't know how valuable it is. You just don't. You're like the example in real estate of the Rembrandt in the attic, right? You got mm-hmm. you got the old couple selling the farmhouse for $150,000. Then the guy comes and walks through and he finds an old dusty Rembrandt and he's like, suddenly this house is worth $5 million to him, right? Mm-hmm. But the old couple, why are they willing to sell it? Because the Rembrandt is just a dusty old painting for them. And your stories, your life experience are often like that. They because you already lived them, you already got the lesson from them, you no longer have the pain that story resolved. The story doesn't have the same level of impact to you. So you don't think it's valuable. Wrong. Anytime you've had an emotion in your life, you've been living in a story, and that story will be valuable to somebody. So you put it in the story journal. And the way you put it in the story journal is you have a title, you have roughly how long it takes to tell the story, 6 minutes, 8 minutes, 30 minutes, and the bullets of the story. And that's it. Now, when you have that, what happens is somebody comes along and says to you, hey, I want you to do a talk on this topic. You can now flip through your storyboard and look at the tags you've written, or you can use something like Evernote and you can search. I need to do a talk on sales. And suddenly you can find all of your stories on sales. Mm-hmm. And you can go, hey, I got 20 of them. Which three do I want? And here's what's really beautiful. When you do this really effectively, all right, I'm in Mykonos, Greece. I'm speaking for my now publisher. They weren't my publisher at the time. They just invited me to speak. I do a 20-minute sort of TED style talk. Publisher comes up to me that night at dinner and says, Eric, the audience had a complaint. And I'm like, oh my God, what? Like what? What did I do? They said the complaint was we didn't give you enough time on stage. Could you do another talk tomorrow on the final day of the conference? Now, conferences never have extra time. It doesn't happen. Uh-huh. But they made the extra time. But now I didn't prepare anything. I was only doing the one talk. I flew from Vancouver to Mykonos at the last minute to do. I'm like, what the hell? So I go into my room. I decide the topic. Because guess what? I said, what do you want me to speak about? And they said, anything you want, which is always a good sign. That means they have a lot of faith in you. And so I picked the topic that I wanted to do. I go to my story journal. I flip through. I pick 4 stories I'm going to tell. And I go deliver that story on stage. Here's what happens. 3 weeks later, the producer calls me and he says, you know, your talk was the second highest rated of the whole conference. There were 20 speakers there, some of the top most like really serious speakers. But then he goes, and I'm saying, thank you. And he goes, no, don't thank me yet. He says, your second talk, the one you made up the night before, that was the number one talk of the conference. Mm. I had never delivered it before. I had never practiced it. I'd never rehearsed it. It was authentically coming from my heart because I lived my stories. And there's one other thing that this gives you. First of all, if you base this around the points that you want to make,
you go, I have 5 points I want to make. I have 5 things I have to remember. That's it. That's all. I don't need notes. I don't need to memorize shit. It's I have 5 points I want to make. And I know what stories I'm using to make those points. And here's what's great. You now have complete time flexibility. You have the ability to take that story, that talk, and do a 20-minute version or a 2-hour version or whatever somebody asks you to do. I was doing a talk. You've probably heard the story because I think it's in one of the programs you did. But I was doing a talk in Manchester, England, and I was booked to speak for 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. They cut my time down to 30 minutes because of a conflict. And first thing is, when they cut my time down, how do you think most speakers react to that? Tantrum. Most of them, I can't believe you cut the 15 minutes. I flew all this way. And my answer was, no problem. And that actually freaked the producer out. She's like, really? No problem? I got no problem. In the meantime, another guy's having a problem with his Mac and needs to borrow my Mac. So I can't fix my slides. So now I'm not going to use my slides. Guess what? You should never need your slides. The speaker who needs their slides, that's when the projector breaks. So you don't need your slides. You can have them, but don't need them. Now I go on stage to do my 30-minute talk that was supposed to be 45 minutes. How do I do that? Well, every story is flexible. A story might take 6 minutes one way and 12 minutes another way. You can tell the story in different ways. So I just shortened up the stories a little and I did my 30-minute thing. But when I had 5 minutes to go, they showed me a 5-minute warning sign. But when I had 1 minute to go, they showed me another 5-minute warning sign, which at first I thought was a mistake. But then I realized they needed me to do an extra 5 minutes. Then they showed me another 5-minute sign. Then they showed me a 15-minute sign. Then they showed me a 30-minute sign. And I was on stage for 90 minutes because the next speaker missed their connection. And here's the
man, they're loving you, huh?
The audience,
this guy can do it all.
The audience had no idea that anything was wrong because at no point did I go, oh, you guys need an extra 5 minutes. Oh, you're screwing up the production of your event. I just went with the flow because all I needed to do is go, wow, this story that I'm telling a 4-minute version of it. But now that I know they need to, I can flesh it out. I can go into more detail. Mm-hmm. And so it gives you basically black belt skills on stage to use a story journal with a speech map.
Jake, I promise this is the last long answer question. We could be here for another 3 hours. This is important, everybody. This is a high level technique. I think it's called the charisma pattern. And I think Jake and I were doing it subconsciously. He's more the visual sometimes. I try to be more the kinesthetic and auditory, but this is important. This is when you're becoming a gangster, as we like to say, whatever, but it's really being intentional and you can work on this and it's entertaining. So can you go over the three modalities, what the charisma pattern is and how it's really can be impactful when you're delivering a speech?
Sure. We all have that friend that's super, super quiet. And we all have that friend that's super loud and super fast and what have you. And then we all have friends that are somewhere in the middle. In neuro-linguistic program, in psychology, they talk about these people as being kinesthetic or feeling-based people, mm-hmm. auditory or sound-based people, and visual or, you know, visually-based people, image-based people. And the issue is that if you've ever met somebody, well, how about this? Have you ever talked to that person who's so damn quiet that you like kind of lean in and you just can't hear what they're saying? And you know, well, mm-hmm. that person was having a conversation with somebody who shouts. And if you've ever had a conversation with somebody who stands just a little too close, well, they were standing with somebody who's very evasive and is always moving away. And the point is that we all have comfort zones. And if you've ever met somebody who you felt like you knew them for 10 years after 10 minutes, it's because you basically used the same language patterns. You spoke at the same cadence. You spoke at the same volume. You had the same proximity comfort. You had the same level of eye contact comfort. Some people like a lot of eye contact. Some people don't. What we want to recognize is that our audience has all of those people in them and we can't use one. If I want to get rapport with one person and they talk quietly, then I just talk more quietly and I can connect better with that one person. But if I have an audience, I can't do that. They're all in there. Some of the people are loud and some of the people are quiet and some of the people are in the middle. And so what that means is that in my talk, I want to be able to, and I've done it even now as we've been talking in the interview, There are times you really got to lower your voice and connect with people deeply. And then there are times when you're relaying information and it's more, the cadence is more regular and so on. And then every now and again, you get really excited and you punch something out, Tony Robbins style, you know, and you get it out there, right? Mm-hmm. So the charisma pattern though, addresses a very important question. And that is, how should you start? Because you see a lot of the, especially people who have modeled themselves on Tony Robbins, is they'll jump out and they'll start their talk like, yeah, let's go everybody. We're going to kick ass today, which is great if you're doing a motivational talk for a bunch of visual people. But if there are kinesthetic people in the audience, they're calling the police. They're like, who the hell is the crazy person on the stage, man? So now you have to do something different. And that is what they call the charisma pattern. Nothing I invented. I don't even know where the name came from. I just, here's what you can notice.
Go back and look at the talks, the great speeches by JFK or Martin Luther King. You will notice that they, you know, Martin Luther King didn't walk out onto the, where was, you know, the Washington Monument, and he did the whole I Have a Dream speech. He didn't walk out there and go, I have a dream! Like that, that's not how it went. It went, it started, he was an incredible speaker, you know, speaking as a minister and all that stuff, right? So he comes out there and he says, we're going to talk about some things, and we're going to talk at this voice. And I have this idea that little black boys and girls and little white boys and girls can play on the streets together in harmony. And he built it up, 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 and he goes, and that's why I have a dream. And, you know, like it's this pattern. And the reason is that if you start off softly, then you don't lose anybody, but you get the soft people. Then you warm it up. You don't lose anybody, but you get the medium people. Then you hit it up. And now what happens is even the softly spoken people are going, I'm okay with this person. I'm okay with a moment of this. Mm-hmm. And you've brought the whole audience into your sphere of influence. And now you just ride that roller coaster for the rest of the talk.
Jake, I know I'm killing you with that, because I know you like got out there screaming and getting going on, but you got me.
Hey, Gino, we got 7 minutes. All right. So we're going to take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Gino, I know a lot of our listeners are wanting to take their multifamily investing business to the next level. I know that you've been hard at work helping Jake and Gino students do just that using our framework. Can you explain to the listeners how they can get our help?
Guys, we've been hard at work growing our community of like-minded investors, and the results of our members has been nothing short of incredible. We're looking to grow this amazing group. What we're looking for is those who want to follow our proprietary framework that we've created. Buy right, manage right, and finance right. Leverage our connections, education, and mentorship as ways to take your business to the next level.
So if you're interested in finding out more about how you can become a part of our amazing community, apply to work with us at jakeandgino.com/apply.
All right, gang, we're back. I get the storyboards, slotting your top stories for the speech, totally connected there. I think the one piece for myself, I'm getting greedy here, that I want to hear more on is how do you get better at actually telling the stories, though? That seems like the final component of that.
Great question.
I'm going to answer that, and then I'm going to inject one more question that you need to have based on who I think your target audience is, and I'm going to try and fit it all in here. Everybody becomes a pretty good storyteller after the third glass of wine. Why?
So get hammered.
Well, what happens with alcohol is that alcohol is both a stimulant and an inhibitor or a depressant. So what happens is that people's social constructs of themselves are released with alcohol, and then they're given all this extra energy. And so they start emoting more, and they tell their stories with animation and stuff. Well, that is what a great story is. You just have to learn to do it without the alcohol. You have to let your ego off. Alcohol kind of dissolves your ego, or dissolves your concern about your ego, is it maybe a better way to put it. So now you're willing to tell that crazier joke. You're willing to use your voice more loudly and so on. So that's one way to think of it. Here's another way to think of it. Tell the story as if you're speaking to a bunch of 12-year-olds. Because you see, when you're talking to adults, you tell them, I want to speak properly to adults. And I've learned that this is the tone of voice that I should be speaking to adults.
And I think and pause and yeah.
And it's all like, you know, and it's all very Toastmaster style. You know, it's like a very clear, and which is a great style in certain situations, but not really for storytelling. And so now the weird thing is, if you're talking to 12-year-olds, you're way more inclined to go, hey, boys and girls, today I want to tell you about how I got my first job. And when I got my first job, I was so excited. I was nervous. We talk like that to kids. Well, guess what? Adults want you to talk like that to them too. So it's really a matter, in my opinion, to tell a great story is, first of all, to remember that you should be remembering the story. Okay, there's a really, really great woman named Janet Atwood. She co-wrote the book, The Passion Test, multiple New York Times bestseller. She and I were both speaking at a conference in Copenhagen. She walked up to me and she says, Eric, how do you do that? And I go, do what? She goes, that thing you do. What thing? She goes, that thing where they sit at the edge of the chair and they don't check Facebook and they let their bladders fill up and don't go to the toilet. Like, you hold them there for like an hour and a half. How do you do that? And I go, I said to her, do you really want to know? Because she's been speaking for years and years and years. I don't want to be presumptuous here. You get permission to coach. She goes, yeah, I want to know. And I go, well, you got to tell stories. She goes, I'm telling stories. I go, no, you're not. You're relaying facts. Mm. You're relaying facts. Now, telling stories and relaying facts are not the same thing. Just because there's a story logic to the facts doesn't mean it's a story. A story is told with a story voice, and it's told with color. And I said, can I tell you your story back? And she goes, yeah. And I go, well,
I remember the story, you know, you ran away from home, you went up to the Haight-Ashbury district in the 60s, you ran out of money, your friends got you a job. Those are the facts, right? And she goes, yeah. And I go, now at one point you talked about your car. Do you remember what kind of car it was? No, I don't know. Okay, never mind. So now I jump in, I start telling her the story, but I tell her first person. I'm going, yeah, I was up there in San Francisco and God, it was the scene. Everything was so incredible. It was the middle of the hippie movement. And the thing is though, is I started running out of money and you know, my friends would buy me dinner, but the next thing you know, I'm having lunch and I'm wondering if I should order something. Cause if I order something and they don't offer to pay, I don't have the money to pay. But if I don't order something and it turned out they were offering to pay, then I'm going to starve. And anyway, I was going through it, but then my friends got me this job and I was so excited. I got to the job and I pulled up outside the job. And as I'm describing this, she goes, red Ford Escort. Why? Because I was telling the story in a way that extracted emotion from her. And there's the key. If you want your audience to feel something, you have to feel it. And if you want your audience to remember information, they have to feel, because the only thing that causes a memory to actually install is emotion. If you have an event with no memory of any kind, you will not remember, no emotion of any kind, you won't remember it. But if you have an event with really significant emotion, you will totally. Matter of fact, PTSD is too much emotion, locking a memory in. So we have to tell the story with all the detail and flush it out and allow it to, you want to give them a journey, take them somewhere.
So everyone write that down on your storyboard. It's information times emotion equals memory. That's very, very important. I don't want to gloss over that because that's a really key component to that. Because I know I've heard it from so many different gurus, whether it's Jim Quick or whether you're doing it on Mindvalley. I've heard that so many times and it really, everyone lock that into your mind. It's so important. Information times emotion equals that memory.
Now there's one more thing. When you're doing a presentation, it is not about you. Now, let me take something. Sometimes it's easier to learn something when you take it out of your ballpark for a second. So a book proposal. If you are writing a book proposal for a publisher, the mistake most people will make is they will write the book proposal all about the book. This is what my book is about. This is how it's going to help people. This is how fantastic it's going to be. This is how many words it is and so on. Publisher doesn't give 2 pages worth of hell for that. 2 pages on that is enough. They don't want to know the rest. The book proposal is all about why the book is going to be a bestseller, not the book, but how you're going to market it, how big your list is, who your partners are, what kind of budget you're going to put into marketing. That is what's going to sell the book. Why? Because that's what's important to the publisher. So let's take that same concept and apply it to investors. One day you're sitting with a group of investors, and if you think you can design one signature talk that can work for all investors, then you're in the 80s, you're in the 1980s of raising money. But if you're in the today of raising money, what that means is you want to learn everything you can about the investors. And you want to craft the talk so that they understand that investing with you is a values match with why they would invest in something. Now, this is very obvious in networking. If I take you to a party and I go, hey, that guy over there, he's a total environmentalist. Then when you go raise money from him, you know you can use his environmentalist stuff to get rapport with him and learn about him. And you know what kind of a projects to go
to. We do the Fannie Mae Green program for all our properties, which has a water reduction strategy and is great for the environment. And I'm saying in a little boy voice, aren't we safe and comfortable together, guys? I'm learning. Right.
Quick learner.
but Jake, I would even go a step further. I would say, God, you know what? I was working on this one development and these guys were putting the money in and it turned out it was going to take out this duck pond and they didn't care. We dropped the project. We're out. We're not doing that, right? So your version was to sell, which is fine. My version was to create the market. It's a little
brand,
like sell me
brand,
the Jordan
it's like
Balfour.
Brand rapport, right? It's like brand rapport almost. This is what our brand is. This is what your brand is. And this is why we're a good fit, right?
It's even more than that. It's Jordan Balfour says, sell that pen, right? Mm-hmm. You don't sell the pen on the features and benefits of the pen. You give them something to sign. Now they need a pen, right? So you kind of think the same way. So when you're talking to a group of investors, it's so important that you speak to them in their terms. It's not all about your project and it's not all about ROI and it's not all about tax advantages. Those things are important, but you really want to have stories in there that are resonant with their values. And then you've got them.
Love that. Beautiful. All right, Gino, it's time to tell a story. And a nice, soft gaze, comfortable voice. Bring us home here, big guy.
Eric
Edmonds. No pressure.
We're 11, 12 years old. I can see Eric dumping ice into the bathtub. Grab some beers. He's surrounded by socialists, and he's called the dirty C word, the capitalist. And at 15 years of age, love that picture. Best picture in the world right there. And at 15 years of age, Mr. Edmeads becomes homeless, not in Florida, but in Edmonton, Alberta, where it's minus 40. And I think he uses his creativity there, Jake, to actually get a job, to go live somewhere. And he has an amazing transformation. I mean, his entrepreneurial venture from there starts these amazing companies. WildFit is an amazing brand, Speaker Nation. He's been a transformational coach, transformational speaker. And for me to be able to, you know, bump into him on YouTube, start watching his videos, the only person that I can watch on YouTube for an hour and a half with his hand in his pocket, doing everything wrong that speakers do wrong, but being captivating and not worrying about style, but delivering tremendous value and tremendous energy and tremendous authenticity. That's what his brand's all about. And, you know, I'm honored and humbled that he came on, spent a little bit over an hour with us. And if you guys haven't gotten, you know, any kind of value from this podcast, you should go back and listen to it again, because there's so much value in here. And for all of you guys that are raising capital, listen to him. It's not about you. You're not the hero. You're the guide. The person you're speaking to is the hero. Anything else, Jake?
No, that's fantastic. Eric, thank you so much. This was a tremendous value to our audience, and we really appreciated all the time you spent with us. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome. I get to do a lot of these, and some of them are more fun than others, and this is definitely in that category. It was a great time.
This is the fun show, okay? This is the fun show.
Thanks, Eric. Take care, everybody.